Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why some GOP state lawmakers are pushing a plan to stop cities from imposing new taxes or fees.
And what we talk about when we talk about books.
But first, as candidates across Arizona campaign for this summer's primaries and the fall's midterm elections, the Trump administration is continuing to look back to the 2020 election. Senate President Warren Peterson earlier this week confirmed that he'd complied with the subpoena and turned over documents to a federal grand jury related to the widely debunked audit conducted of the 2020 election in Maricopa County. Yesterday, Attorney General Chris Mays and Secretary of State Adrian Fontes sent a letter to county recorders around Arizona encouraging them not to turn over voter data to the federal government if they are subpoenaed. With me now to explain what's going on is Wayne Shutsky from KJZZ's Politics Desk. Wayne, good morning.
Good morning.
So who is looking into this now? Because it seems like there's more than one potential investigation going on here.
Yeah, as far as we know, there are two separate investigations at this point. There's the one you mentioned by the FBI. That's the documents from the 2020 audit that Senator Peterson turned over. And then there's a separate investigation, it looks like, by DHS, HSI.
Homeland Security.
Homeland Security, yeah, that they've requested some information from Attorney General Chris Mays' office that they gave them. They said most of it was public records anyway, and that had to do with a lot of reports and things like that that former Attorney General Mark Brnovich had put together when he was in office during 2020 and in the aftermath of that election.
So what is it that Senate President Peterson turned over to the FBI?
We don't know the specifics because they won't tell us. I have records request pending. But documents related to the 2020 audit. So, you know, it's 6 years ago now. But to take us back a little bit, that was when in the aftermath of the 2020 election, a lot of voter fraud claims flying around, especially from President Trump and his allies. The Arizona Senate decided to subpoena a bunch of records from Maricopa County and conduct its own audit with the cyber ninjas. We get to say that again.
Mm.
And, you know, this is a group that had no sort of past history doing audits, but they did it anyway. It was full of issues and problems. It ultimately still found that Joe Biden had won that election.
By more than what the official tally
had found.
But again,
also like a lot of election professionals, audit professionals said that, you know, you can't really trust anything that came out of that because the methodology was just so flawed. So anyway, it's documents related to that. I believe President Peterson eventually told VoteBeat that ballot images were a part of that tranche, but beyond that, we don't really know.
And it's probably worth noting that Senate President Peterson was sort of co-overseeing that audit with then Senate President Karen Fann.
That's right. Yeah, he was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I believe, which was over, which, yes, was in charge of that. So every photo kind of the hearings on this is President Fann with President Peterson right next to him.
And can you talk a little more about the documents as far as what we know of what the AG's office turned over?
Yeah. So again, these are reports. Basically, former Attorney General Mark Brnovich, the late Mark Brnovich, was looking into all these different voter fraud claims that came in at the time. He was obviously also seeking a seat in the U.S. Senate. So a bit sympathetic to the president's claims. And these documents, you know, so it's really just him basically in his office basically chasing down all these different theories. And so the attorney general turned over, Mays turned over what they found or didn't find in those cases. And then additionally, some analysis from the Mays' office as well, showing that, you know, basically nothing came of a lot of these claims, including state lawmakers who were making claims in public about voter fraud, Senator Wendy Rogers, Senator Mark Fincham, being invited by the then attorney general's office to show them what they knew. You're saying there's voter fraud. Show us what you know. I believe Senator Fincham showed up and then said he did not have any proof to back up the claims. And then Senator Rogers refused to come and meet with them.
Has the attorney general or the secretary of state been asked or subpoenaed for anything else that they haven't given them?
Not as far as we know. Again, we don't. I don't believe the attorney general's office was never subpoenaed. That was all voluntary again because they said it was mostly public record that they were asking for anyway, stuff that's been previously released. So they were just giving it to them. And, you know, notably county elections officers as well in Maricopa County said they have not received any subpoenas for any of this stuff. So it looks at least at this point like all these requests are isolated to kind of rehashing claims about 2020 and the investigations that were looking into them.
Is there a difference between what the FBI and what the Homeland Security investigations are trying to find?
Again, the FBI declined to comment. We're not hearing a lot coming out about what they're actually looking at. But based on the records they're looking at and the kind of what each entity is tasked with, we can kind of make some assumptions. You know, DHS is looking typically deals more with immigration people in the country.
Mm-hmm.
Without authorization. So you can think they're probably looking for evidence of the president's claims that people who are not citizens are voting. And then FBI may be looking at broader claims that, you know, conspiracy theories that we saw pop up during the audit, everything from bamboo ballots to blank or fake or ballots being injected into the system.
Yeah.
All these things that there's been no evidence to show, but again, that the president and people close to him have continued to push.
Are folks making a comparison between what's happening here and what we saw in the Atlanta area in Fulton County, Georgia, not that long ago?
Yes. Yeah. I actually spoke with the States United Democracy Center yesterday, where they're a pro-election group. They do have ties to Governor Hobbs, AG Mays, Fontes. They've helped them with certain legal issues, but they're a pro-democracy group who've fought back against claims of, you know, widespread voter fraud without any evidence. And they're basically tying it all together. They're saying basically it looks like the Trump administration is going after all the swing states that he lost that delivered the election to Joe Biden in 2020. So Georgia was one of them. Arizona's one of them. They say they're expecting to see similar efforts in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania.
All right. So I'm going to ask you, which I am reluctant to do, but I will anyway, to move into the world slightly of speculation here. Do we have a sense of why this is all happening, or do folks who are involved in this have a sense of or speculation as to why this is all happening right now?
Yeah, like I said, I haven't gotten any response from the administration asking why they're looking into these records. But again, these democracy advocates, some Democrats, they've basically speculated that they're trying to sow doubt ahead of the 2026 elections. Obviously, we've all heard that 2026 is not expected to be a good year for Republicans, you know, so there's the possibility that Republicans could lose the House and that would hurt the president. And in that case, they're speculating that the president wants to sow doubt in the results of these elections so that then when they come in, they can challenge them.
Interesting. All right. Lots more to keep our eyes on. KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky from the Politics Desk. Wayne, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
State lawmakers are considering a pair of proposals that would stop cities and towns in Arizona from implementing new taxes or fees or increasing ones they already have through the end of June 2030. One of the measures is a bill that would go to the governor. The other would go directly to voters this fall. Both won preliminary approval yesterday in the State House. During a committee hearing last month, the sponsor of both, Representative Justin Olson, a Mesa Republican, said they'd help Arizonans deal with the high cost of living.
It will cap that rate to make it easier for folks to make ends meet and to adjust to this high cost of living. And if a city can't live within its means with the existing rates, then it needs to find ways to be more efficient with the tax dollars.
Olson said the moratorium would mean cities and towns would not add to the burden residents are bearing when it comes to prices. At the same hearing, Greg Blackie with the Arizona Free Enterprise Club, which supports the proposals, told lawmakers cities need to tighten their belts.
Any budget shortfalls are not a revenue problem. It's clearly a spending problem and a large one. As the sponsor already mentioned, city budgets have increased 60-70% over the last several years. What taxpayers or families have seen their budgets grow by that size? They haven't.
But cities, not surprisingly, have a different perspective. I spoke earlier this week about this with Rene Guillen, executive director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns, and I asked him about his members' objections to this proposal.
Sure. And, you know, if you don't mind, Mark, just a little bit of context, too, for, you know, I think the perspective that my members, the mayors and their councils, you know, bring to this when we look at these measures, House Bill 4030 and HCR 2052, you know, you have to keep in mind really where the world we're dealing with is a world where we've recently lost the rental tax, which the legislature's own budget arm penned at an impact of $230 million a year. And we have the HERF, which is mostly the gas tax, which hasn't been touched and adjusted since the 90s. And this fall, the voters of Arizona will be voting on the food tax, which would lock that in. So in a lot of ways, we've already had our revenues, you know, constrained. And so, you know, for the mayors of Arizona, when we see these measures that really would tie our hands when it comes to controlling our revenue and controlling our budgets, you know, they see it as a major intrusion on that local control, that budgeting authority.
So there's obviously the preemption concern that mayors and councils have. There's a sort of a revenue concern. Do you get the sense or do you hear from various cities and towns that some might be affected more than others if this one of these were to go into law?
I would say, you know, universally, it is, you know, cities and towns are opposed. They are concerned. You know, I think for many of them, they see this as these bills as, you know, potentially, you know, existential, because when you look at cities and towns in Arizona, at the end of the day, we are service providers. You know, if you look at the core of what cities and towns are required to do in state law, it is public safety and transportation. And so in a lot of ways, you know, you can't do that for free, unfortunately. So we need to be able to generate the revenue to provide those services. And so, yeah, I think every city and town is concerned about these measures, because we have to be able to, at the end of the day, nobody likes to pay taxes, right? But we need to generate that revenue to provide those services. And when you look at, you know, utilities, we have to generate those user fees and collect that revenue to provide those utilities. And in today's environment, you know, unfortunately, we are coming face to face with the fact that we live in a desert. And as we look in the news, and you've probably covered it, that, you know, the Colorado River isn't mm-hmm. generating the water that it yeah. once was. And so that means water gets more expensive, and we have to acquire that water and deliver that water and treat that water. And we need to be able to generate the revenue from our users to be able to do that.
Now, one of the supporters of this proposal said for cities that are concerned about it, and especially concerned about budgets and budget shortfalls, the comment was, this is not a revenue problem, but a spending problem. I'm curious, you know, what you make of that.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting point. I mean, I think my initial reaction is it's an easy allegation to make. It would be helpful if there were examples, right? You know, when I look at, you know, cities and towns, I often point to the fact that we are required by state law to have a balanced budget. We don't, you know, we are not, you know, spending money willy-nilly. We are providing services. We have to have multiple meetings. You know, there's clear state law that dictates the process by which we develop and pass a budget. Another point I would say is when we are going to raise a tax or even a fee, there is a process in state law that requires us to provide additional notice to our residents that we are planning to do that. So none of this happens in the dark. We have to be very transparent when we are raising revenue. We have to be very transparent when we are adopting planning our budget and then adopting our budget. And frankly, I would point out, none of that applies to the legislature.
If this idea were to go into a law, either because the governor signed it or because it went to the ballot and voters approved it, what would that mean for cities? Like, how would they react to this? What would it mean for their budgets, and what would it mean for residents?
Sure. So, you know, there's a couple of, you know, consequences that I think we would have to deal with. So, you know, within the parameters of the legislation, you know, it creates this 4-year moratorium. Now, it does say you can raise, you know, taxes, fees, utility rates if they're approved at the fall of the even, you know, election year cycle.
If voters approve it.
If the local voters approve it with a 60% majority. Now, the problem there is, right, I think, you know, we all want government to run quickly and efficiently. Well, that now means you're talking about government delayed. And I think we now know over the last decade that inflation can mean a lot over 2 years. And unfortunately, infrastructure tends to not be getting cheaper, tends to be getting more expensive. So how much cost are you now adding to a project because you're now delaying that vote until you can get to the ballot? So there's one real world impact that these measures would have. Another one that we're learning is that, you know, the reality is with a lot of these projects, you will bond for them. So let's talk about, you know, infrastructure, right? Everybody would love to cash finance, right? I would love to cash finance, but guess what? I had to finance my car. I had to finance my house. I think that's how most of us are. And when we are talking about water and wastewater and transportation facilities, we bond because you'd rather have that highway today, not in 20 years. You'd rather have that sewer or that water today, not in 20 years. So we use bonding for that. Well, the reality is when you look at the covenants that you enter into with these bonds, a lot of times there are terms in these contracts that actually require you to have the authority to adjust your rates to cover your debt service, to ensure that you have the revenue to be able to cover your bonds. And failure to do so can result in those in penalties. It can result in them becoming callable, which is financially dangerous. And then going forward, if these bills were in law, either because signed by the governor or passed by the voters, you know, what would that do for the exposure risk on the bond market, right? If you're a city in Arizona and you're trying to now issue bonds for future infrastructure, you've now got this albatross over your head of, you know, you've got these bonds you want to sell to build this infrastructure, but you now have to have this big sort of warning sign of, hey, I may not be able to generate the revenue through utility rates because of this restriction placed on me by the state.
Do you think that would ultimately result in fewer of these projects getting built?
You know, it could. I think the other piece of that is it's going to shift that burden from the user fees, which I would like to think is, you know, a fiscally conservative idea, an idea that a lot of us would get behind, that the people using and benefiting from the service pay for the service, right? It's now going to shift that to the general fund. And frankly, you know, who do we fund out of our general fund? Those things that can't be funded with a user fee, like transportation, police, fire, right? Some of those key services. And so, you know, to your point, if you're choosing between funding a sewer infrastructure project or funding police and fire, you're probably choosing police and fire.
All right. That is Rene Guillen, Executive Director of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Rene, nice to see you. Thank you.
Yes, likewise. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, want to make science lectures fun? Maybe try adding beer.
But first, earlier this year, the Washington Post announced a wave of changes, including the end of its books section, Bookworld. In the wake of the announcement, hundreds gathered at Politics and Prose, a bookstore in D.C., carrying their well-worn Bookworld tote bags to mourn the loss of a beloved source of literary discourse and criticism. The announcement has prompted a series of follow-up articles about the state of criticism, including one at LitHub that got us talking here at the show. In a piece called No Stars, or Are We Reviewing Ourselves to Death?, writer Lucy Britch pondered a post-critic world. Among other things, she wondered if it might usher in an era of increased creative freedom for artists and encourage readers to make their own choices and develop their own opinions. To explore those questions and to get a better sense of why the Washington Post book world mattered to so many readers, we invited the show's resident book critic, who also used to contribute reviews to the Post, Mark Athatakis, to the studio. I asked him what he thought about all this, and he didn't hold back.
There is no lack of people on the internet who are eager to tell you what they think about what they've read, either in Amazon reviews or Goodreads, and those all have their place. And there's also no lack of high-end, thoughtful, essayistic literary writing in the London Review of Books, the New Yorker, the New York Review of Books, Harper's, and so on. Both of those ends of critical discussion are fine. What we're losing is the middle. The Washington Post was one of the best representatives, I thought, of the idea of a newspaper review where people who are not necessarily automatically attuned to reading about or learning about books can still find a way to discover them in a thoughtful way. And that's what's disappearing.
When you were writing for the Post, is that something you had in mind editorially as you were, you know, sitting down to write your review?
Absolutely, because I have to assume when I am writing for the Washington Post or any daily newspaper that anybody reading it needs a little bit of an introduction to who exactly you're talking about. But I appreciated that because that's what I grew up on. When I grew up reading the Chicago Tribune literary section on every Sunday, and that was my introduction to just this world of books and how people talked about them and argued about them. So it was an idea that it was almost like reading the sports pages, that you're keeping up on the latest debates.
Right. It's coverage as much as it is criticism.
Exactly.
So another thing that I hear in what you're saying, and tell me if I'm not getting this right, is at a place like the Post or the Chicago Tribune, there's also perhaps implicitly an invitation into this world, mm-hmm. whereas with those other publications, there's an assumption that you're already part of it.
Right. You know, I think there's a misperception for people who don't necessarily engage a lot with criticism about what criticism is. And I think that it's perceived as a thumbs up, thumbs down thing, that we are either praising things to the skies or we are damning them or we're writing pans. But I think more often, and I think the people I know and the critic I try to be is somebody who is, yes, rendering a judgment one way or another, but also providing some context, also just trying to do a little bit of education. And, you know, for a writer like me, and I think this is true for a lot of people, like you discover what you feel about something as you are going through that process of sitting down and thinking about it. And that's part of the process that I've always really enjoyed.
Yeah. This book didn't appear in a vacuum. It is part of a continuum of this author's life and of the cultural context in which it's appearing.
Right. You know, sometimes the question is not just how is this book? Is it good or is it bad? But why does it exist in the world? Is it part of a trend line of things where, you know, particular authors from particular places get privileged attention? And what is maybe missing from that? I think that's the other thing, too, that as we pare back the outlets for reviews to appear, there's fewer opportunities for those books that come from independent publishers that, you know, kind of find their way through the cracks. The opportunity to put a spotlight on those books is disappearing.
Well, and I suppose someone might hear you say that and think like, well, that's the niche that TikTok is filling now, or that, you know, social media outlets are filling, where something can kind of capture the algorithmic hive mind.
Yes.
and come to the fore, even if it doesn't come from a major imprint or press or something. But I feel like what you're describing is something that is being lost, where one critic who had a deep relationship mm-hmm. with their readers right. could surface something that they didn't just personally feel like they were on a mission to, you know, get more people to read, but that they thought, because of the interactions they've had with their readers, mm-hmm. would resonate and wasn't getting, as you were pointing out, you know, maybe comes from a community of people who aren't getting enough attention, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think that's one of those things that, and I think we're kind of almost a generation past the era where daily newspapers had staff critics that were writing twice or once a week, and you knew what their tastes were, you knew what they were interested in. So if they were going to suggest, hey, take a flyer on this thing that's a little bit out of left field, it might be more encouraging for people to try it. And what we've had in the last generation is a lot of people like, frankly, me, you know, an army of freelancers that may feel undifferentiated to a reader. You know, this LitHub essay that we may be talking about is talking about criticism as something that is almost uniformly negative. But I think in the worlds that I'm in, the main complaint is that reviews are too overwhelmingly positive, that there's mm-hmm. the real estate is so limited that if you're going to write about a book, it has to be a rave or it has to be enthusiastic. Otherwise, why are you wasting the space on it?
Right. One of the other arguments that the essay was making was this idea that by decreasing the influence of – I don't know if she was specifically saying referring to reviewers as gatekeepers, although I know many people do. Mm-hmm. But by decreasing the influence of critics, mm-hmm. perhaps it will usher in this rediscovery for people of the joy of just reading whatever's on your parents' bookshelf mm-hmm. or just going to the movies and watching whatever's showing that weekend and kind of deciding for yourself whether you like it or you don't like it. And from this experience, which she remembers very fondly, one's taste is forged.
Mm-hmm.
And that there is a joy in doing that, and that there is an attendant joy for artists in feeling like, I'm going to feel more confident in putting my ideas out there without worrying that I'm then going to have to deal with this onslaught of reviews that may tank pre-sales and whatever.
there's a lot to be said about that.
Yes.
I think the first thing I would say is that I personally feel no particular urge to leap in front of somebody at a bookstore who's about to reach for a book that I'm not particularly fond of. I think if you are reading and going through that process of discovery for yourself, that's all to the good. And I think it also assumes that, you know, people behave in this very sort of localized way that all I'm going to do is just free float through discovery of books and that will be pleasurable to me. But I imagine that for a lot of people, if you read a book that you're interested in, if you like it or you are mad at it, one thing that you might want to do is talk to other people about it or find out what other people have to say about it and discovering criticism that way. That's certainly what happened to me when I was young, when I was trying to puzzle my way through William Faulkner and, you know, it led me to reading criticism of William Faulkner. So, you know, the internet, no doubt, toxifies a lot of things. And one thing that it can do is toxify criticism.
Sure.
I think people will misbehave in this culture, but I think they're also still craving those sort of conversations. They're still interested in sharing. I mean, that's why you see something like Book Talk happening, because people, you know, want to share what they are excited about.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, it's not necessarily all bad, and it's also not the end point of how we have critical discourse.
Well, Mark Athatakis reviews books for many publications, many outlets, including still KJZZ's The Show. Mark, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. It's been 2 years since Arizona voters overwhelmingly passed Proposition 139 into law, enshrining abortion rights until about 24 weeks gestation in the state constitution. But it's just now that many of the other restrictions that have been put in place over the years surrounding abortions in the state are also being struck down.
Just last month, a Maricopa County judge struck down several restrictions, like a 24-hour waiting period because of Prop 139, but many more are still on the books.
Our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke more about it with Elizabeth Ling, Associate Director of Legal Services at If, When, How, an advocacy organization aimed at protecting reproductive rights.
Last month, the court ruled that several restrictions are now considered unconstitutional following Proposition 139 or the Arizona Abortion Access Act. Specifically, there were previously laws that required healthcare providers to provide patients with biased and inaccurate information. And this was information that came from the state. That information had to be provided to anyone who was seeking an abortion in Arizona in person, so physically at the clinic. And they also had to be provided at least 24 hours before someone was able to get care. And so that effectively meant that anyone who wanted an abortion needed to make at least two separate trips to a provider.
Yeah.
So that restriction has now been struck down. And so people will be able to get care in just one appointment now.
Right, right. There was also a restriction about the reason that folks might get an abortion, mm-hmm. right? And that's no longer going to be in place here.
Yeah, that's correct. So there was previously a law that said the reason for getting an abortion could not be because of a fetal diagnosis that was non-lethal, meaning that if the diagnosis was not something that was going to result in the death of the fetus, that couldn't be the reason why someone was seeking an abortion.
Tell us also about this restriction on providers being able to provide telemedicine. Like, Arizona mm-hmm. residents could get abortion pills through the mail, even with this law in place, but this changes things for providers?
Yeah, so it changes things for providers and for people in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So prior to this decision, people in Arizona, like people all over the country in states where there are abortion restrictions or abortion bans, are able to get abortion pills by mail. And there's a number of different ways that people can do that, including by accessing care from healthcare providers who are licensed and physically located in different states and allowed to mail abortion pills to their patients. But now what this decision does is it's removed the restriction on telemedicine within the state of Arizona. So that means that providers who are physically located within the state of Arizona are now able to use telehealth to prescribe and mail pills to their patients.
Right. And this is all happening, Elizabeth, right? Because Arizona voters overwhelmingly passed Proposition 139, which enshrines abortion rights in Arizona's constitution. It's to do with protecting abortion rights before about 24 weeks, the point of viability for a fetus, right? So I think folks might have assumed that Prop 139 passing kind of automatically made all of these restrictions on abortions go away. It didn't.
That's correct. And that's a really understandable confusion, right? The way that our legal system works is that when laws exist, they will continue to exist unless they are challenged in some way. And so although Prop 139 did amend the Constitution in Arizona, any law that existed previously was still on the books until someone actually challenged that law as unconstitutional. And that's what happened in this case.
Okay. Okay. So your organization has a hotline, right? A national abortion hotline that you oversee, I understand. So it sounds like you kind of get a sense of the questions like this that people have coming from certain places. Tell us what you hear coming from Arizona. What kind of questions do people have?
Yeah, our Reaper Legal Helpline is a national legal services helpline. We talk to people from all over the country about all kinds of reproductive decisions that they may be making, including abortion care. And so I would say the questions that we get from folks in Arizona are not so different from the questions that we get from all over the country, right? So ever since Dobbs, with there just being constant changes in the law, differences in the law in terms of people's ability to access care, there's a lot of confusion and people don't know what the laws in their state say. So people in Arizona have called us certainly just wanting to know, how can I get an abortion? What are my rights when it comes to accessing abortion care? Especially considering in Arizona, you know, there was previously a 15-week abortion ban that was also struck down. And so there's been a lot of shifting in terms of people's ability to access care. Mm-hmm. People ask us questions around things like those state mandated counseling requirements, prohibition on telemedicine, things like that. We also get questions from folks in Arizona and elsewhere around their legal risk and their legal rights when it comes to accessing abortion pills by mail. Because while it is not a crime in any state for someone to end their own pregnancy, with the exception of Nevada, and that's only after 24 weeks, unfortunately, people have still faced some type of legal consequence when they've made that decision. Mm. And so we talk to people about what that legal risk or the chance of getting into legal trouble could potentially be for themselves. And that's based on, you know, what laws say, their circumstances, where they're located, and a bunch of other different factors that are really particular to each person.
Right. So it sounds like every time the laws shift like this, and there has been so much of that of late, as you're pointing out, people call, people have questions.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you, though, because these particular restrictions that have been struck down now in Arizona are certainly not the only ones that are still on the books. There are many more. I want to ask about some of the laws that are still on the books. I know there's one at least that's been talked about quite a bit, which still restricts abortion prescriptions and procedures to physicians. Like if you're a nurse practitioner, a nurse midwife, you can't perform this. Is that also being challenged?
Well, I think that those restrictions that really limit who's able to provide care are really harmful to people and to community members, because you're really, again, limiting access to who is able to provide care when there's really no science or evidence to suggest that it's not safe for those other advanced practitioners that you just named to be providing that care. Hmm. So I think that those are certainly laws that will continue to be challenged. What does it truly mean for something to be a constitutional right when it's not accessible to everyone?
Yeah. Let me ask you lastly, Elizabeth, what do you think these particular changes mean for access and maybe also for providers in the state? I think for a long time, Arizona has been seen as a state where maybe abortion providers don't want to be because there were a lot of restrictions for a long time. And those are loosening now. Do you think that'll change and that'll affect access for folks?
Yeah, I certainly think this will affect access for folks, right? We've talked to so many people on the helpline who are able to get an abortion in their state, but they're not able to make those two appointments, right? Because that requires people to take time off. It requires people to get childcare. It's expensive. And so removing these barriers, which might not sound really significant, can make a huge difference for people's ability to get the healthcare that they need. And I would say for providers, I can only imagine and assume, right, not needing to undergo steps that are not supported by science and that are not, you know, in someone's medical judgment necessary are huge, right? And to be able to provide care to their patients without unnecessary visits and providing them with disinformation, I think those are all really, again, I can only imagine significant changes for providers in the state of Arizona.
All right. Elizabeth Ling, Associate Director of Legal Services at If, When, How, joining us. Elizabeth, thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate your explanation here.
Of course.
new collection of essays looks at the tortured relationship between the United States and its workers. It's called Capturing Labor, and it's co-edited by Texas State University professors Jessica Pliley and John McKiernan Gonzalez. I spoke with McKiernan Gonzalez yesterday. The book presents a series of case studies that explore America's long history of exploiting people as workers long after the abolition of slavery, with a particular focus on the Southwest.
Three of the cases have to do with the ways in which women in Texas were identified as potential sex workers, were then tested for syphilis. If the test came back positive, they're placed in a treatment center for about 3 months, if not 6 months. And while they were there, they were expected to work and make goods and provide services that would help the treatment center keep itself going. None of this was with consent. There wasn't any judicial determination in this, but that's like a really classic example of this.
It strikes me, John, that one of the things that this book is exploring is the identity of the worker, and in particular, the itinerant worker, which is sort of hardwired into American culture as this valorous thing to be, the sort of salt of the earth idea. But this notion of the ideal worker has long been quite racialized, right?
If a teenager managed to walk all the way from the Guatemalan border all the way up to Austin, jumping up and off trains, they would be valorized as someone incredibly brave and resourceful and impressive. We don't do that right now. We sort of like we arrest them and treat them as criminals in particular ways because they're not U.S. citizens, or they don't come off as U.S. citizens. They come off as Mexicans or Guatemalans or Haitians. In a sense, the same kind of sort of like response by authorities to people walking the streets. I think women literally walking the streets of Tucson, of Calexico, of El Paso, and being picked up is a really good example of people who are denied the ability to freely move around the city in search for work. The idea that we can go anywhere and get a job is deeply ingrained in the United States, but the idea that others can also do the same thing, look for jobs and try to do their best once they get the jobs, is not necessarily allowed.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the risk of asking an obvious question, and, you know, you've alluded to some of this already in your previous answers, but do you see the Southwest as particularly fertile territory for, or perhaps an ideal laboratory for exploring these issues?
What I find particularly interesting is sort of like abolition happened earlier in this side of the Americas, but at the same time, you had ways in which people were still rendered unfree, whether it was being captured in the sort of like Indian Wars that happened, being placed into adoption, finding ways to draft people. The rapid expansion that happens with railroads that gives local authorities a great deal of control over people they decide are itinerant or not. And I think this comes crystal clear in the case of the 1933 Fabens cotton strike in El Paso, where that's sort of like seen as a quintessentially rural situation, a cotton strike, except that the picket line was actually the bridge in downtown El Paso, the illegal saloons that were in sort of like Barrio Segundo. There were fundraisers done out of dance halls and to sort of like support the strike. So it's a classic sense that the city residents understood the strike as an urban labor issue. But the people who ran the city of El Paso, the social workers, the relief authorities, the landowners, and the head of the Chamber of Commerce thought that if people were working in cotton, kind of the act of working in cotton, you give up your labor rights, you give up your sense of workplace equality, you give up your sense of dignity. And if you rebel against that, you should at the very least be driven across the border to Ciudad Juárez, where you're no longer a threat. So to me, the Southwest is actually sort of like more thinking of it as the borderlands, and the having that physical border that's there also gives people the authority to draw national distinctions between people who live in incredibly multi-ethnic Tucson, incredibly multi-ethnic Albuquerque, incredibly multi-ethnic California. The ease of symbolism of defining who belongs and who doesn't belong.
Yes, yes. And one of the most active conversations in labor in America right now is this idea of the quote-unquote gig economy and all of the various problems that come up around that and the way that more and more companies are relying on it. Do you see a connection between that conversation and what you're covering here in Capturing Labor?
I had the joy of running through the peonage cases in Texas when I was sort of like doing some of the research, the background that did this. And one of the issues that came up is that labor contractors in South Texas were charging other labor contractors in South Texas with peonage because they would recruit workers from outside of the high schools during sports events, load them on cars, drive them all the way from Westlaco to Saginaw, Michigan to work in the strawberry fields, and they wouldn't get paid in the strawberry fields. So to me, the larger issue, of course, was sort of like the rise of transportation, the willingness of people in South Texas to take on this risk because sticking around in South Texas might mean that your adult kid might get drafted and sent off to war and you'd lose their ability to have them be able to contribute to the house. And in the process, engaged in a kind of very porous exploitation of family labor that allowed sort of like farmers to sort of like thrive in Michigan, thrive in Indiana. I think the question of itinerancy, the reason people can do this and the possibility of it changing brings us back to the New Deal, to sort of like the Fair Labor Standards Act included workers, not citizens, included workers who worked for factories, for employers who employed more than 10 people who weren't farm laborers and who weren't working as domestics. And that sense of giving people the opportunity to have an identity as a worker that was enforced by the state transformed workplaces across everywhere. And I think here it's the same kind of question of itinerancy. If there is a way to provide as close to universal a floor for if you're working for someone else as domestic, this is the expectation for how much you should be paid. If you're working at a warehouse, this is what should be expected in return. And it would be nice where our wages wouldn't have to generate our health insurance. And what this book illustrates is how hard it is, whether you're a restaurant worker in San Antonio in the 1960s, a woman, a Mexicana in Mexicali in the 1920s, a person who's had deep neurodivergence or perhaps not so deep neurodivergence who happens to be Mexican in rural California, how hard it is to get your rights as a worker recognized.
Well, we have just barely scratched the surface of the book, which is called Capturing Labor, and I have been speaking with its co-editor, John McKiernan Gonzalez. John is associate professor at Texas State University, where he is the director of TSU's Center for the Study of the Southwest. John, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. If you're looking to learn a little bit about science but would rather hang out in a bar than a lab, an event tonight in Tempe might be for you. Science on Tap is a monthly gathering that features two short science talks. Tonight's topics, sting operation, from jellyfish to reefs. Marion Legall is an entomologist. That means she studies insects, not words. She's also the organizer of Science on Tap. She joins me to talk more about it. And Marion, if someone comes up to you and asks what Science on Tap is and why would I be interested in it, what's your sales pitch?
My sales pitch would be that, A, the price is right. It's free. it's once a month. And also, like, I used to be a teacher, so I'm aware of, like, annoying, long, dragging lecture. So Science on Tap is the opposite of that. So I usually have two speakers. They can come from different area of research. So you can go anywhere from physics to math to biology, from different organizations. So they can from ASU, U of A, like park services, private sector coming, and they will give two talks that are only 20 minutes each. And then after each talk, you have opportunity for Q&A for 10 minutes, and we have a break between the talks so you can refresh your drinks if you need. And so everything is wrapped under an hour. The idea is to make it very accessible and not boring. So like, you know, and also like very important things, I ask all the presenter to make the presentation accessible to a broad audience. So you do not have to have a college degree to come to Science on Tap and enjoy it.
Okay, so they're shorter presentations, but like, how do you make sure they're still interesting? Because as I'm sure you know, something can be, you know, 20 minutes and still not be that interesting. It'd still be kind of boring.
Right. Well, so like selfishly, I pick topic that I think would interest me.
Okay.
And then like I ask my friends around, or sometimes people volunteer to me for the topics. And I think people like scientists, often we have to publish, you know, like a peer review paper, and they're often behind, you know, a paywall. And I think people like scientists usually love talking about their work. We spend so many years, you know, getting our degree, and we actually like talking about research. And so like it's fun because it's a different format. So it's not a conference. You're not talking to your peers. And so usually I think they do a really great job because they're generally like happy to do it.
Well, so for someone like you, you are very much in the world of insects. How much of a challenge is it for you to, for example, describe your work or to have a talk like this that isn't at a scientific conference? You're not talking to other people who are in your field or who work in your lab. You're talking to people who might know nothing about entomology.
Right. Well, that's one of the issues. I feel like we're not necessarily trained for that. So like I'm very much trained to talk to my peers. But because it's something I enjoy and I'm passionate about, I think I've read a lot about, you know, like technique for teaching. I also taught at the university. So like same thing, like learning about like tools and just my like personal interests. So like, or one thing I do is like I look at people that I enjoy that are very good science communicator, and I copy some of the tricks they use.
How do you come up with the combinations of topics that you're going to be talking about?
As I said, it's pretty random. So like some of them is like selfishly. I'm like, oh, I know nothing about that. So for example, like I study biology. I don't know much about math or physics. So I'm like, oh, yeah, I'd like to hear about black holes, for example. Like I don't know anything about it. Or sometimes recommendation. Or it also happened that people come and volunteer to me. So, for example, this week we're going to hear about a jellyfish. And that was someone that attended Science on Tap and is about to be a grad student. And she told me she studied upside-down jellyfish that photosynthesize. And I was, how could I say no?
Who tends to show up to these events?
It depends. So I feel like there are some regulars that have like enjoyed Science on Tap from the beginning, and like I will see them monthly. And after that, I advertised on a Facebook neighborhood group. So like people from the hood, quote unquote. And after that, it's also like sometimes people who present, they'll bring their friends or like other people from the community. So I'd say change month to month.
So why do you think an event like this is so important to be doing?
Well, because as I say, right, like a lot of the science we publish is not accessible because like when we publish article, they not aim at a general audience. They're very jargony. And even if they were not jargony, they are often behind a paywall. The open access paper are more common, but not always the case. And I feel like there's a lot of miscommunication with science. I think that became very apparent during the pandemic. And so I think like bringing science to the general audience and making an effort to like not use that particular jargon and training yourself to have like this elevator pitch that is addressed to like a broader community is really important. And also it's fun, I think.
Do you see this as kind of a way to maybe combat misinformation or even get people to sort of trust in science and believe in science again? They see, you know, scientists are real people standing up in a bar, maybe with a beer in their hand, talking about something and in a way that is understandable.
Yeah. And actually, that was the reason I started Science on Tap. So a friend and I were talking about how we were in grad school. We had experienced something like that. So like I'd been to like a science cafe when I was in grad school. And at the time, I never really thought about like anything more than attending. But then during the pandemic, I grew increasingly frustrated with, you know, like really like the miscommunication about science. And I thought, well, what am I doing as a scientist? And I felt like not really a lot for the, you know, broader community. And so my friend felt kind of the same. So we decided, well, let's do it. There was not really something like that in Tempe at the time. And the other thing is like, yeah, I really think there is a misrepresentation. So often if you see in the media, common image of scientists going to be like, you know, generally it's going to be a white male in a lab coat. And scientists are like a lot more varied. And so, yeah, I think it's really good for us to like go talk to the public and like, yeah, be more, a bit more human and meet at the bar where like, you know, someone can come and ask questions.
Any topics that you haven't been able to feature yet that you'd really like to?
Yeah, actually, that's I have been trying to get someone to come and talk to us about AI, I think that'd be a great one. I would love to hear more about like solar energy. And being in Arizona, I think like a semiconductor. So I have like tried to reach out and yeah, I would love to feature a story because I feel like they're very Arizona centered.
Yeah. Maybe down the road at some point?
Yeah. And I've tried to invite some people, but I don't usually struggle to find people. So like, you know, like I usually jump to another topic and we'll come back to it eventually.
All right. That is Marion Legall, the organizer of Science on Tap, also an entomologist. Marion, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, that will do it for the show on this Thursday. Thank you so much, as always, for listening. If you want more show in your life, a couple ways to achieve that goal, you can head to Instagram and follow us at KJZZ The Show. And you can also visit theshow.kjzz.org to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Radio Heads, where we've always got lots of great bonus content for you. Thank you so much for listening once again. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 9. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then.
Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman.